Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 7th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Children and the Christian Faith, presented by Bonnie Miller McLemore. Disc number MIB 2005-03.
And that they identified like honoring the body, household economics, saying yes and saying no, keeping the Sabbath, testimony, discernment, shaping communities, forgiveness, healing, dying well, singing, that were the 12 practices that they initially focused on. Each of these practices is something we do together daily around basic human needs, and there's long traditions that support these practices. When we say religious discipline or spirituality, we sometimes don't think of these as constitutive or formative of our faith lives, but they're really trying to redeem these daily practices. A sociologist, Robert Withnow, has done some study of, has a book that he published called Growing Up Religious. And it's a fascinating study in part because he really discovers that it's not so much the formal practices, even though they are very important, that is corporate worship or individual prayer, but it's often the daily habits of our routine, eating and sleeping, conversation, how we adorn the spaces we live in, how we celebrate holidays, that are really pivotal to faith. So here's just a quote from him. The act of praying was sometimes more important than the content. So your children may not remember what you said at night around the dinner table or when you pray, but more the act itself. Being in Sunday school was more memorable than anything taught. Now, I don't want to make a dichotomy here, like what you're taught is not important, but so the quote, fried chicken or satyrs or statues of Mary were the texture of our spiritual lives, unquote. Here's another little, I throw this out there, it's very interesting as a parent. Children may be more influenced by seeing you read, or read the Bible, I mean read anything, or read the Bible, or as having the Bible read to them. Again, it's an interesting thing to reflect on, that for them is as formative because they see you modeling. Now this doesn't mean that teaching and formal teaching or worship are unimportant. It's just a nice analogy that Dorothy Bass and Craig Dykstra used is, or actually they're quoting a wise pastor that compared acts of worship to daily life, these practices of daily life, as sort of the difference between consommé and broth. The real, you know, that the worship is sort of like thick, dark, rich, a heavy dose, and next to the broth of everyday life. Now, parenting is what not yet even the first tier, the second tier. It's sort of a third tier. And here, I think Luther, again, I've drawn him before, is helpful in redefining vocation as all that we do. And so parenting is a practice in even a different way. It's really a vocation as much as it is a self-contained practice, like honoring the body, keeping the Sabbath. It often is a cluster or a group of many practices that those of us who work with children are doing daily in many different ways. So in a way, I thought if worship is consommé and individual prayer is consommé and daily practices like keeping the Sabbath or the broth, you could think of parenting as a pot of stew. And just, you know, in essence, it is a more encompassing practice. So, so today, in the next couple days, I really want to look at different practices within parenting. Not that any of these are the way that we embody faith, or any of these to be idealized, but to say any of these practices can be reclaimed as faithful living. And each of us, and this is similar to the work that Dorothy Bass and Craig Dykstra did, each of us have favorites, ones that we do better than others. And any practice can lead you into the faith life and generate other ways of practicing. So let's look at pondering a little bit. Maybe one way I wanted to frame this, but I think I want to go straight to pondering. How am I thinking about that? Was to put it embedded in the one thing that makes religious this kind of second, third tier difficult is the catch of time. When I talk to parents about the challenge of raising children and the role of faith, I received one constant response, and that was time. One parent described the biggest problem as that of, quote, managing our children's lives and time. And the difficulty of embracing parenting as a spiritual practice really is heightened by the challenges of raising children in an environment that some have called toxic. Some have used the image of war, that our culture is really kind of waging war against us. Here's a wonderful quote from a historian who did some work on 19th century. If the 19th century paradigm of domestic life was sort of this Victorian patriarchy in prayer with his wife and children, a century later, the image of the middle class family is more, quote, the heavily annotated kitchen bulletin board next to the busy telephone. She's really captured the ship. It was one thing for Victorians, she says, to raise godly children in a relatively static, sheltered institutional setting with the prospect of daily reinforcement from school and church. In fact, this community kind of re-embodies that in a bit. But how do we, as parents, what do when we compete with, quote, schools, sport teams, television sets, and toy manufacturers for time and attention, for our children's time and attention and our own? Pondering may not be the answer to this, but maybe it's a place to start. A father, after 10 years of parenthood, says this: I can barely remember our life without children, a life where I wasn't so lifted up and so weighed down, so blessed and so utterly confused, so stunned by wonder and stung by worry, unquote. This is sort of, for those of you who were in the last session, this is sort of a connection for where we left off, because here this father talks about the birth of, we were talking some about the epiphanies that surrounded the birth of our children as monumental, and this father is struggling with how to move from this, what he calls this time-stopping or kairotic moment, the fullness of time, of kairos, the word he uses, to the chronos, the ongoing dailiness of time. In the past few years, he says, as the girls have started school and fallen into their own schedules, I've lost some of this kairos sense of time that birth teaches. And I see some nods, yeah. And we're maybe too big of a group to go around, but I know we have relationship with children at various stages, and I will say the older they get, the more distant some of those kairos moments become. I mean, I don't want to be depressing for those of you who are younger. They become farther, fewer, farther between, and we talked about this some the last couple days. Making contact is takes more work. So this question of attention and pondering maybe becomes even more challenging. So let's look a bit at pondering. It may not be the ultimate solution to this dilemma, but it's maybe one window, one way in. Recently, I joined Herbert Anderson, who's a good Lutheran, good friend and colleague of mine, and we were doing a series of lectures sharing the different Lutheran seminaries. He did the series of lectures at four of the seminaries, and I did the other four. But we were able to join each other and do them all at in Chicago. And so I heard, and I already read, one of his lectures was entitled Ordinary Awe, which I think fits so well with what I've been trying to say about reclaiming the ordinary. And in a way, he comes by this title rightfully as a good Lutheran. He quotes Luther. Luther says, this is just a small phrase, wonder brings faith. Wonder brings faith. However, awe, and he talked about this a bit, gets lost. It easily gets tamed. There may be lots of reasons why we tame awe. It may be that it really is bring us too close to the unknowable nature of life. But and he asked, he realized one way he discovered that we truncate it is by, we have this phrase, wow. We say wow all the time. He interviewed people and asked people, so what do you mean when you say wow? And what he discovered is that this sort of wow, an expression of awe, repeated out of habit, I use that a lot actually, is sort of a way of, it was just another mundane way of saying you don't say, or you're kidding. Or we say wow and we don't know what else to say. So sort of his sense of a way in which we maybe lose a sense of awe. But awe is a really important disposition of the soul, as he says. And what would happen if we reclaimed this? So good parenting, care of children, really does require sort of this ordinary awe. And I think one of the places where it really appears in our scriptural text is in Mary's pondering all these things. This text, I really never paid much attention to this text until I became a mother. Did that happen to anybody else, that this phrase stood out? With children in tow, the words Mary kept all these things in her heart literally jumped off the page for me. And it wasn't really until I was asked, there's very little attention to Mary among Protestants, and a couple women decided to edit a book on Protestant perspectives on Mary and asked me to think about Mary and motherhood. It wasn't until I was asked to do that I finally looked back at these passages and began to ask myself, what do they mean? And doing so, I flipped through a book that I had written on motherhood, also a mother, and I discovered there on the first page, staring me in the face, the word ponder, maybe subconsciously. And really that book does ponder the dilemmas of mothering in a complex adult world of work and family. But why was I attracted to this phrase? I think as a mother, I had maybe indirectly, partially in a very contained Protestant way, maybe tried to identify with this image of Scripture, with Mary, and admired in some way from a distance her pondering. Now, if we look to the text, there's not much on, we don't know much about Mary. There are not a lot of scriptural passages. Her pondering appears in two places, first at the birth narrative, and then it reappears again after the 12-year-old Jesus gets lost and is found 3 days later in the temple. So you have Mary, the shepherds telling Mary that her child is a savior, and all this, what I see is probably chaos and wonder. And all you know is she, quote, kept all these things, pondering them in her heart. And later, upon returning to Nazareth to watch, and this is again a scriptural quote, in a quote, an obedient son grow in, quote, wisdom and in stature after he'd been gone 3 days. Mary kept all these things pondering in her heart. Now, what could Luke be doing here? Some, particularly feminist biblical scholars, think that this is just one more time where the male tradition and the male authors are silencing the voice of women. But I'd like to just think a little further than that. I'm wondering if Luke deserves some credit for the brevity of his portrait. That in these two instances, he's very careful about not putting words in her mouth because he cannot capture the breadth and depth of what she must be thinking. And maybe is demonstrating some restraint as he searches for the right way to preserve her dignity as a subject. Here I want to say, is Mary one of the first prayers of the tradition? We talked some past couple days about the way prayer had been limited and defined by monastic church fathers who were celibate. But no, here is a example of prayer in the midst of chaos. Forced, maybe as the first theologian, to think about who is this child and what has God got to do with all of this in the very midst of the chaos, not when she got away from it, not when she went off to the desert. So what about this word of ponder? Let's think about it for a second. The dictionary offers a lot of definitions for ponder. To deliberate about, to think about earnestly. Synonyms are meditate, ruminate, muse. They all, however, I think one thing they have in common is they're all about a focusing of one's attention. And I want to say in this word ponder, you have attention, you have awe, and you have anguish. Now, we're not going to talk about anguish. I'm kind of saving anguish for our final practice of mundane grief, of parenting is always grieving, always letting go from the very beginning. But I want to focus mostly on attention today. And here you have pondering is really what another way to think about it might be prolonged consideration. It's what we have to do all the time as parents. It's inconclusive. We don't, when we reason, we come to a conclusion. When we ponder, it's, as one dictionary said, an author who talks about this phrase in Luke, it has a heavy, slow sound. There's a lack of resolution that you don't find in words like reason, assess, analyze. That's so much more characteristic to what we always have to do when we are parenting or caring for children. The kind of sonorous effect, the heavy, slow sound, really connects back up to the passage where it's not in her mind. She's pondering in her heart, a little bit different location. It doesn't negate that parenting isn't often about really serious thinking, but it reflects how parenting has to always be some more complex connection between thinking and feeling, always. And even, I would like to say, a kind of wisdom, that your work, that your spiritual practice of parenting is honing a kind of wisdom of thought and feeling that is complex. Keeping thoughts in your heart means keeping them sort of at the core of your being. And finally, I think that use of that word involves a certain acceptance of realities that just go beyond her understanding, and that kind of points towards anguish. And in fact, if you go back, this is maybe getting a little ahead, but if you go back to the Lucan passages, there is woven in them a foreshadowing of what is to come, and a sense of anguish and the limits of her ability to really ponder everything. Now I want to connect this back up to parenting, and I know it has been, but one of the persons who's done a lot of work on reclaiming the practice of parenting as a valid practice is a philosopher, Sarah Ruddick. And she's done some wonderful work. She has a book entitled Maternal Thinking. And the book was really a shock to the world of philosophy, because she was really claiming the practice of parenting as marked by a particular kind of thought that arises out of the practice of the care of children.
Can you say the title again?
It's Maternal Thinking, and it's Sarah Ruddick, R-U-D-D-I-C-K. And what's nice is that she, as a philosopher, has sort of tried to bracket her mothering and then finally realized that it shouldn't be trivialized, it shouldn't be dismissed, but that it has attributes every bit as valid as the most rational philosophical thinking. And one of the attributes that she reclaims is this idea of maternal attention, parental attention may be a nice way to think of it. She's looking back to the work of two other philosophers, Simone Weil and Iris Murdoch, both of whom talk about prayer not as petition, not as words, but as attention. Attention to God, which is a form of love. And so she's using that idea that prayer consists of attention, when the whole of your being is turned toward God. But she's trying to reclaim this as a practice that we do when we parent. Attention requires a kind of patient hovering, an anticipatory openness, a waiting upon truth. The ordinary mother in some ways, or the ordinary parent and father, you have to ask again and again in different ways, over and over, what are you going through? We talked about this some yesterday. And to do that without giving up your own self. A phrase from another author on this is, it's a loving which draws us constantly out of ourselves, but we hope still constitutes us fully as selves. We don't lose ourselves in doing this. And without rushing to give an answer. So for Ruddick, maternal attention means, she has some really nice ways of talking about this. And she talks about it as regarding children fully real without seizing or using them. It's a really hard thing to do in some ways. It's a difficult practice, it's a difficult discipline. Again, in her words, a posture of holding, in quotes, governed by, these are her words, the priority of keeping over acquiring, of conserving the fragile, of maintaining whatever is at hand and necessary to the child's life. I think that keeping over acquiring is a helpful one. It's so easy to start to use children for our own needs. Another thing that she says is that we try to do this even though we sometimes can make no sense of what we hear. And even when we can, this is her phrase, barely tolerate the child that we're trying to understand. She compares it some to empathy, a phrase that has become quite, we use it a lot, it's a popular term for sort of putting ourselves in the other's shoes. But she tries to distinguish it from empathy by saying, attention is when we can't put ourselves in the other's shoes, and we simply have to attend. We can't identify with what they're going through. Now, what's, I think, really helpful is not to romanticize this, because we've had such a destructive pattern of romanticizing, particularly the maternal ability to attend to children. And instead see it for the discipline and hard work that it is. And that there is much about taking care of children that makes it impossible to attend. The intensity of the work, the daily wear of it, the indifferent social context that we talked about a second ago, the toxic war of culture, and the clamor of children themselves. Sometimes it it just our own exhaustion makes it impossible. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that this sort of attentive focus of the maybe of the Luke and Mary can offer maybe some kind of vision of hope or guidance as we think about the difficulties of attending to children in the midst of the chaos of life. If we attend well, we perhaps have these moments of a quote from my own work: if I attend well to my three sons, there can be opportunity, maybe not regular opportunity. I wrote regular, I should say irregular opportunity, for astonishment, for spontaneous humorous comments. This is 14, 16, and 19-year-olds I'm talking about, what, you know, which are often few and far between. By their sheer persistence in the face of daunting challenges. When they get the age of my kids, even by shoes that are larger than mine, or the day this last winter when my 14-year-old stood in front of me and said, "You know, I'm looking down on you now." And by very small acts of kindness, again, from 14, 16, and 19-year-olds are not as common as 4 and 6 and 9-year-olds. Simply put, I think we can often be caught in attention, in awe, and live through our moments of anguish. So I think I've talked a lot. I haven't got as much back from you all.
I'm going to draw a connection between Mary pondering and the child growing in wisdom. Because for me, the pondering is where I get wiser as a parent, too. And I see you drawing the pondering as the connection with God, but I think it's also the connection with the child. And being able to have those flashes of insight about, oh, the child's changed again, and this is where I need to go. It's taking what you know in your head about child development or your neighbor's kids or your sister's kids or whatever, and making it work in your house for what needs to happen for the child to continue to grow in wisdom. And so I think there's actually a lot unsaid, like you said in Luke, but I see that as being Mary's role. The child doesn't grow in wisdom on his own or only from being in the temple or probably not even only from God, but mediated through Mary and Joseph.
Yes, I think maybe a sort of free association from what you're saying that's interesting is that in this shift from a spirituality defined around silence, the image of God there in the Greek world that influenced that form of spirituality was God as sort of unchanging. So spirituality was to get away from the material changing world. The changing world was seen as something we were entrapped in that we wanted to get beyond. And I think what in this different view of spirituality, what one of the challenges is living with the perpetual changes of children's needs and lives, and coping with that, and assessing that, and making judgments as they change and grow, and also standing in awe of it. I mean, in some ways, the shoes bigger than mine or the shoulders taller than mine is standing back and being amazed by the growth.
Well, doesn't it also connect you more with your own parents when you suddenly go, oh, that must be what they were doing with when I was, you know, a kid, or now I understand why we did this or that instead of this or that. But, so it's a generational thing.
Yes, yeah.
So it's a little tangential, but there's a good book called Showing Mary by Renita Weems.
Oh, she used to be a colleague of mine.
Yeah, and is she Protestant?
Yes.
And so it's a great book. It's kind of an Advent-ish book. We read it. A friend and I read it this past Advent. But good reflections on Mary. Imaginative reflections, because Scripture doesn't say a lot, but kind of taking contemporary life and imagining maybe what Mary and Elizabeth were going through in those days.
She's a Hebrew Bible scholar. She used to teach at, I didn't say anything about my background for some of you who are new, but I teach at Vanderbilt Divinity School. She used to teach at Vanderbilt Divinity School and then decided to just totally write and speak.
Is she black?
She's African American.
She writes black.
Yeah.
And she writes ethnic, you know.
She also has a really nice, talking about spirituality, she has a really nice book called Listening to God that really expresses some of her own struggle as she made some transition from a Pentecostal background, academic education, where you stand back and critically reflect on your faith, back into her faith and reclaiming her faith and living through really some of the periods of silence, God's silence, in her life. So she's a really nice author, and I haven't looked at that book at all, and who writes for the wider public in very helpful ways. I was looking for a quote, too, that gets to this in an article I used yesterday that sort of critiqued it on love and attention, that critiques the received tradition of spirituality. At the end, this person turns back to love and attention. And although I didn't find that part of this article as helpful as her critique of received spirituality, she has a nice phrase in it where she's actually quoting Iris Murdoch, but the task of attention goes on all the time, and at apparently empty and everyday moments we are looking. Making these little peering efforts of the imagination, which have such important cumulative results, unquote. That's from Iris Murdoch. Then she goes on to say, the object of attention is not changeless truth, which used to be sort of, you know, it's how our Christian tradition was shaped by Augustine and early church fathers. And that's the God we're contemplating. No, the object of attention is not changeless truth. It's a moving target. And children, in fact, are creatures of change and chance, and our attentive gaze on the real, in their case, is a gaze on a constantly changing reality. I wrote in the margin, in the extreme. I mean, again, my kids are older now, but what I do remember is some frustration about this when they were little, because just when you felt like you kind of like got it, you know, then they were on to the next thing. And you were sort of always catching up, whether it was, you know, you couldn't, I had three kids under five at one point, I just couldn't keep up with their clothes. You know, literally, the growth in terms of clothes. And a friend actually went out and bought some clothes, you know, and brought them to my house. I mean, because it was so, you know, that kind of thing. But I think this gets at some of that. Another piece that she gets at the end of this is Janet Soska's article called Love and Attention, is that attention is really a work of the imagination. And it takes effort. It takes moral effort. Even though this isn't her phrase, in reading this, my senses that attention is a stage towards the spiritual. Maybe back to the theme that I really feel like I'm circling around is, as you try to do this, you are honing a spiritual discipline that is of value, not when you get to church and pray. I mean, not that isn't also, I should say, both and, it's not either or. I'm trying to enrich how we think about prayer, that this kind of work amidst the daily mundane is itself a valuable discipline. Does that make sense?
I think, which is not to say that you don't also, as a parent, need a break.
Yeah.
And what you use that for, you have this for your own purposes, but it might be for some solitude in prayer sometimes.
Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out how do you make a mundane activity, doing the dishes or whatever, clothes, how do you make that spiritual? I mean, you think about it intellectually and say, this is a needed activity, it's showing my love and my caring. But, you know, that's sort of on an intellectual level. I mean, when you really think about spirituality or worship, there's a lot of emotional activity. It feels spiritual when you go to church, you know, because of all the stimulus is coming in with the spiritual icons and the music and the different things. So how do you make a mundane activity be spiritual? How do you make that transition?
Mm-hmm. It's, you know, Simone Weil, the one person that Sarah Ruddick is using when they use that word attention, talks about it as a gift, that you can't make it happen, that it sometimes is it happens and it's a gift. Sarah Ruddick talks about it more as a, I'm trying to remember her phrase, it's in my notes somewhere, but I want to say a discipline or a work. And I sort of agree with both of them. I don't really want to choose. But I think you're really asking a hard question, because it is clear when you do the concentric circles of ritual, formal, or corporate, or personal, it's clear you have structures set up that are intensely directed towards evoking the spiritual. Whether they succeed or not, sometimes it doesn't work with worship either, personal prayer either. But you're right, the infrastructure is more clear. I think you're raising, I don't have a, I mean, I'd be interested to hear if other people have questions or answer to that question. I mean, and I did, I for those of you who were here yesterday, I talked about laundry as a possible mundane practice that might be potentially filled with the spiritual. But I talked about how not always that way, and there are times when you're just like I was before leaving for Holden, just why don't my kids fold their 25 t-shirts and why'd they wear this many, you know? And I couldn't really get into it, you know, I just wanted to get it over with.
Toilets are worse than laundry, I think.
I don't know, when I work in housekeeping here, that's exactly what I work on, and it's such an opportunity to just, you know, I think about those toilets and I think about those sinks. I think about the people who are going to use them, and if I don't clean them well, they could get sick and their vacations would just be spoiled. And it has really built in me, I mean, it's, you know, it's like doing reps on a weight machine. You know, you got to do it over and over and over and over. Mm-hmm. You know, at times when it's just clean and dirty toilets. And then, you know, I try to get that voice to stop and get back into that notion of service of others.
This might be really simplistic, but comparing going to a service at church, you know, has meaning for you versus, you know, doing the laundry. I'm not involved with our church in any kind of pastoral job. So when I go to church, I'm entertained, shall I say. I mean, it's taking time away. You know, when you're doing the laundry, the phone's ringing and the kids are screaming and there's just so much going on. When you're at church, that's the only thing that's going on. And I am in no way involved with anything there. I can just sit there and just let things happen to me instead of me making things happen for other people. And I think that's hard to do at home. I mean, I hate to call it entertainment, but for me, it was, when my kids were little, it was, I would just sit down and just, you know.
Go ahead.
I'll just throw one more thing in, which is, it's that split attention. I would love to have time to just clean the toilet, but I'm, you know, going here, going there, someone's having a fight, you know, the phone's ringing, and it's the split attention. I feel like in the times when I'm even able to get out of the little spin that I'm in while I'm doing this, I'm saying, okay, God, get me through this one. You know, can I do this in a gracious way? I'll always remember a colleague of mine who had three children and she's working full time. She, somebody said, wouldn't you like to have four? She said, you know, I would love to have four, but I just don't know how graciously I could parent four. And I thought, wow. What a great concept, you know, graciously prayed. And here we're having a work conversation, and she just, you know, she's a Catholic, she's very, you know, it just permeates everything that she does in a wonderful way. And I just thought, that That's right. And the idea of graciously parenting, not, you know, in the Southern gracious manner where you're doing for others, but really having grace enter. And the times when I feel like I'm kind of starting to lose it, you know, mm-hmm. I yell, and I know that that's, you know, the thing I work on. I say to the children, you know, I'm working on the yelling, but would you please go to we're open about the fact that we're working on the yelling thing. But just being able to say, God, I'm going to need your help with this one. I know I got to have a little extra, you know, moment here so I can just get through the task without making things worse, much less do it with grace, through grace. So, and I think about that term constantly. You know, when I'm having trouble with things, if I'm able to catch my breath, I think about it graciously parenting.
That's nice. Go ahead.
60-something friend who comes to our house frequently on Sunday afternoons because we're both Tim and I are home and all the kids are home and she knows how chaotic it is. And we're popping popcorn for supper and the house is just wild and she just loves it. But she says she really comes because we as parents need to hear her reflections on her parenting. Not because she thinks we're stupid, but because she says that when she was parenting, she was always surrounded in the neighborhood by mm-hmm. other parents. And they would sit in the afternoons, drinking iced tea and lemonade, and the kids were screaming and they were breastfeeding and they were stitching on buttons and they were, you know, it was loud and chaotic and screaming all the time. But they always heard from each other that this too shall pass, or they were just so grateful that other kids didn't do that. And so today's parents, we don't get to do that. We don't get to be, so everything that happens that shames us enormously because there's not another parent there who says, my child did that too. And almost all of us, if we were to share all the stories about what's happened, whether our child has special needs or not, someone in the room would say, ah, I know someone that happened to, or that happened to us.
Yeah. I hear several really helpful things that would be worth lifting up. There are two dangers that I can hear sort of echoing around sort of redeeming the broader, or actually it was the theme of my first issue, but it is the contemplation in the midst of chaos. One danger is that we have to be careful in our busy world that we don't reclaim chaos that shouldn't be reclaimed. I mean, there's so much that we have too much going on often, too many thoughts, too many obligations, too many responsibilities. And so we don't want to go to that extreme. There is a limit in which chaos is simply chaos and not redemptive in any way. You know, that and there is a need for limits and et cetera. So I hear that kind of in the background. The second one I hear is the real importance that this not be one more burden, one more thing to do as a parent, one more guilt, you know, trip for those of us who's already struggle. And in fact, I love the phrase gracious parenting because it's a reclaiming of a secular phrase that's gotten a lot of popularity, good enough parenting, which is a very helpful phrase. Good enough parenting was a phrase that a object relations psychologist, Winnicott, developed to help parents not strive for perfect parenting, but that sort of range in the middle where you avoid the extremes of sort of overbearing parenting and neglectful parenting. I mean, those are not the only continuum, the only extremes, but sort of something in the middle there that, and in fact, another psychologist that is very helpful, Heinz Kohut, talks about the importance of mistakes, that's where growth occurs. It's true for therapy. It's how we understood therapy, was where empathy broke down, that persons made movements forward and growth. And that way of thinking about parenting is your mistakes as fruitful, not as tragic. If they're, again, in that range of, and I like the gracious parenting because I think that puts puts it in a faithful religious Christian context, in fact, that good enough parenting doesn't. But I sort of hear both of those dangers there as you put your comments out. And another thing I kind of heard us talking about is an image I used the very first day was my son is a big outdoors person, and my oldest, and one of the new things kids are doing these days, I guess, I don't know, I'm not all that in with it, but, you know, is they hang these things called slack lines. They're flat.
Webbing. That's called webbing.
Well, he calls it a slack line.
I mean, that flat rope.
It's like a webbing?
That's called webbing.
And then, you know, walks on it, and it looks really easy. It's like a tightrope, but I mean, it is so hard. And I used that image to talk about sort of the slack line of balance between, earlier some of us were talking about solitude or silence that you need, and the activity that also is fruitful to spiritual life. And trying to find that balance is not an easy one, and everybody has a different balance point. I don't think we're all the same on this score. And so when you said something about you need silence and solitude, I confessed in an earlier session, I think the occupation I enter, which is teaching, there are huge amounts of times of silence and solitude. And I think that was a part of my motivation. Because I'm right in the middle introvert extrovert, but I knew I need a lot of time. So that may be, for me, what sort of sustains me in the chaotic periods of my family life and parts of my work life. Teaching is chaotic too. Yeah.
You know, pondering for me and parenting, the thing that I've learned, twins, Lori and I have twins that are 16-year-olds, you know, and I think that there are times when there can be interaction with my kids, and then there's other times when I actually make a conscious decision, it's not the time, and it's kind of like pick your battles, but it's also, you know, my mind is too occupied with something else, and then there's other times when I make a conscious decision and say, okay, I want to really be with Rachel or Luke. I'm making this decision. I'm going, you know, I consciously make that decision. And those are always the best times. But I also have the freedom to say, no, this isn't really a good time to do it. Because I'm not thinking straight, it's too late or whatever. And I know Lori reacts regardless, you know, there's always a response. And I think that's a gift to it. But I think also, you know, to ponder when it's time. And also to know that God is working in both of them. You know, and that's the thing that God's spirit is also in them as well as in me. Just to be conscious of that, have the attention of that. You know, in their time of difficulties or stage of life, that God's still leading them.
When you first talked about pondering, what came to me was in the situation of Mary was the kind of a calm and a patience, an ongoing patience of you know, not stepping in and you know, quizzing Jesus on exactly what had happened and trying to understand everything and correct where he might be going astray and trying to either put her opinion on or control what he was doing or, you know, just, isn't that interesting that he's out there asking these questions and, I wonder what he's going to discover for himself. And that, we have a 6-year-old and there's times when I find him, you know, just adamant about something being a certain way. And part of me just wants to go in there and correct him. And then there's other parts of isn't that an interesting way to think about that? Let him learn, you know, let him go through that. And that's, I think, for the wisdom and for faith, too, of being able to, you know, ask interesting questions and not always have somebody come in and give you the answer. And so I like that.
Patience is a really nice, that's a very nice piece. It seems like it goes with
pondering.
With pondering. And it's one of the very hard parts of the practice, I think. I used a phrase yesterday, going according to the pace of children. It's actually a phrase from the story of Jacob and Esau, and going according to the pace of the cattle and the children, and how hard that is sometimes. You know, we have our own agendas, and I think partly what you're pointing out, Alice, is sometimes you can choose you're not going to go according to the pace of children. You have to, you've got some of your own needs, and that's that. But there are other times when there's much to be gained by trying to moderate your own adult agenda.
We were talking about epiphanies yesterday, and the pace of children, like how grocery and other kinds of shopping changed. You know, before kids, it was like, you know, go in. After kids, it's like you better just not have a schedule, you know, if you're going to take that child along with you.
Mm-hmm.
And be attentive to their discovery in that event. I mean, sometimes you can't always do that, and you just pick them up, throw them in the cart, and they're screaming, but too bad, you got to get the milk and go. But the pace of day-to-day mundane things slowed way down.
Yeah, I like how you put the overbearing and the neglect, too, on either ends of the spectrum. I mean, you don't always think of that. I mean, a lot of people, I think overbearing is what they have to do to their kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have to control.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I just thought of that after you said that. I mean, it almost is as bad as neglect, which is horrible.
Mm-hmm.
But I never would have thought of it that way.
Have you ever been in contact with love and logic, that the theory?
No, with what?
Love and logic.
Love and logic.
Parenting.
Parenting.
Yeah, there's a series of books, you know, Love and Logic for Parents, Love and Logic for Grandparents, and it's an approach for the children to not control the children and give them choices in a situation so that they can gain some of their power. You know, it's bath time, and it's, well, do you want the strawberry-flavored soap or the watermelon-flavored soap for the shampoo today? You know, they don't get to choose yes or no to the bath, but they have a sense of power in that situation to make a choice, and so that their mind rather than gets to step away from, I don't want a bath, to, gee, do I want watermelon or strawberry?
So you're teaching how to make choices and how to live in a complicated
just keeping, letting them have their powers as they grow up and not continuing to take it away from them, and then them trying to gain it back through behaviors.
And I think love and logic should be balanced with threats and bribes.
Yes. There are the limits of love and logic. But it is a good series. It's a very practical.
That's
what
I do for parenting teenagers. I think it's really effective. I think it's less effective for the babies and toddlers.
I don't know. More effective for the toddlers.
No,
I disagree.
Really?
I don't think it's loving enough.
Oh, yeah. No, I've heard that criticism too. You need to remember the love in the situation.
You have to know where the child is.
It's a lot like
parenting theories out there.
That's true.
Right. Some of them work better with some personalities.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
also
true.
Your personality.
I mean, it does sound a bit like parenting effectiveness training.
Yes.
Seriously similar.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's pre-packaged.
Because I have, even though I never heard of this, I know I use that kind
mm-hmm.
of. But in a way, it's a power play itself. But I mean, it is.
Yeah.
More,
yeah.
It is.
It does.
It can be.
But I do think that at its core, it has, I think, a deep Christian premise at its core, whether it intends to or not, which is a deep respect for the personhood of the child. That the child, even though I haven't done any of that work here, I've done some retrieving of the Christian tradition, and the child really is redeemed in the Christian tradition as a knowing, spiritual being who has important contributions. And that is a core premise of this thing, what I'm doing now.
The other strategy for Yale, and I'll just throw in, maybe we can share strategies, but it's, I liked yours, and then the one I use is, if it's helpful for me to yell at you, I will. And then usually he covers and runs away and does whatever he's supposed to do. If yelling at you helps, I'll do that.
Yes, it doesn't. He's not distractible. He does exactly what he wants to do. His name is Daniel, which means God will be my judge. And we add to that, and nobody else.
You know, it's funny, of my three, I have a Daniel too, and it's like, oh, why did I use that name? He's
that
just like that.
Swally River, which explains a lot too.
Yeah.
But
you know, there's another good book which has pulled some of these same thoughts in it about kids and power struggles, which I'm trying to read in my abundant free time. but it's really good because the idea is, you know, some of the basics are about getting, you know, getting control of yourself in the situation, but then turning those opportunities, not at the moment when they're bubbling over, but after that, to saying, you know, here's what happened here. Now, in the rest of your life, here's how you're going to need to know how to handle these situations. You know, you're going to need to be able to express what you want, not just, you know, scream and cry. You're going to need to figure out how to get a compromise and move through that, because that's what, you know, older kids do and what adults do. And so using those things to say, you know, we're going to help you figure out how to take those situations and make them work so that you can live with one another. And I just think that's, I mean, we're working on it, and it's really hard, but I think it's a really great approach because it honors the child and their ability to learn, not just live in a series of controlled situations over time. And when their parents aren't there, then what do they do?
I think a lot of it, I would say that many of us are living in what I would say is a major cultural shift in how we understand relationships. And some of what you're working out with your kids, and I may be reading this in, is a rethinking that we've worked out as we've already tried to rethink how we understand gender relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So if, in my circumstances, if I'm trying to model in my partner relationship a greater mutuality and shared responsibility for public and private and work and family. We really are in a way that is, you know, 20 years of my prior generation somewhat unprecedented. Well, that means that you do treat your children differently. You can't, you know, preserve this mutual relationship if you're going to just be completely authoritarian with your parents, I mean with your kids. And so in a way, I think what you all are describing, it sounds to me like, is trying to work out a deeper mutuality with dependents, people who cannot be truly mutual yet. And it's, again, like the slack line, it's another one of those balancing points. And for me, the image that we have around dinner table, and I like that because in some ways, everyone's in a mostly equal position. But one day, one of my kids said, why do you and Dad get the chairs with the arms? There are two chairs, right? They're sort of the semi-head of the table. The other chairs don't have arms. And that was an opportunity to sort of say to him, you know, you all are fairly equal, but ultimately, I mean, you know, finally, at some point, we're not giving up our chairs. Not yet. So, and again, I think that is a good image of this sort of change of way you all are changing how you regard your children that may be different. It certainly is different than for me, when we go to my parents' house and they see how we make decisions about where we're going to go to dinner or which movie we're going to go to, they can't stand it.
Mm-hmm.
Because what they would say is, here's what we're going to eat. I mean, as parents.
Yeah.
Whereas we're like negotiating, well, you got to do this last time, so this, and it takes us about 25 minutes longer. And again, my parents were looking at us like, these guys are, you know, weird. But that, I think that's the shift we're talking about. And it's hard, it's a lot of work. We should stop. Thank you all for coming. I really enjoyed this. Well, I guess one that I want to stop on, Steve Rigo's doing a found objects art thing, and I think that parallels exactly what I was trying to do here today. He was having us go out and look at junk as possible art objects, and that is very similar to what pondering is saying. I'm going to look at this mess of my life. Maybe it's artwork, you know? So, thanks for coming.
Thank you.